So then, if you win, what will you take from men who have nothing at all? But if you are defeated, consider all the good things that will slip from your grasp. Let them once taste what we enjoy, and they will cling to it and never be driven off. For my part, I am grateful to the gods for not putting it into the Persians' heads to march against the Lydians. With these words, he did not persuade Croesus. For before they subdued the Lydians, the Persians had nothing of luxury or good. Now the Cappadocians are called Syrians by the Greeks. And these Syrians, before the Persians ruled, had been subject to the Medes, and then to Cyrus. For the river Halys formed the frontier between the Median Empire and the Lydian. Rising in the mountains of Armenia, it runs through Cilicia, and then keeps the Machene on its right as it flows, and on the other side the Phrygians. And passing these and flowing on northward, it forms the boundary on one side between the Syrians of Cappadocia, and on the left, the Paphlagonians. In this way, the river Halys marks off nearly the whole lower part of Asia, from the sea opposite Cyprus to the Euxine Sea. This is the neck of all that land. Its length, for a man traveling light, takes 5 days to cross. Croesus made his expedition against Cappadocia for these reasons, because of a desire for land, wishing to add it to his own portion, and above all because he trusted the oracle and wished to avenge Astyages on Cyrus. For Cyrus son of Cambyses had conquered and held Astyages son of Cyaxares, who was Croesus's brother-in-law and king of the Medes, and had become Croesus's brother-in-law in this way. A band of nomadic Scythians, in revolt, had withdrawn into Median territory. At that time, the ruler of the Medes was Cyaxares son of Phraort son of Deoses, who at first treated these Scythians well, as being suppliants, and holding them in high regard, he handed over boys to them to learn their language and the art of the bow. In time, as the Scythians kept going out constantly to hunt and always brought something back, it happened once that they caught nothing at all. And when they came back empty-handed, Cyaxares, for he was, as he showed, sharp-tempered, treated them very harshly and with insult. The Scythians, having suffered this from Cyaxares, since they had been treated in a way they did not deserve, resolved to cut up one of the boys being taught among them, and to prepare him just as they were accustomed to prepare game, and to bring him to Cyaxares as if it were a catch from the hunt. And having given it, they resolved to reach Sardis and Aliats, son of Sadiats, with all possible speed. This is indeed what happened. Cyaxares and the guests present with him tasted of this meat, and the Scythians, having done this, became suppliants of Aliats. After this, since Aliats refused to surrender the Scythians even though Cyaxares demanded it, war broke out between the Lydians and the Medes and continued for 5 years, in the course of which the Medes often defeated the Lydians, and often the Lydians defeated the Medes, and among these there was also a kind of night battle. As they carried on the war on equal terms, it happened in the 6th year, when a battle had been joined, that during the fighting the day suddenly became night. This change of the day Thales of Miletus had foretold to the Ionians, having set as its limit the very year in which the change actually occurred. When the Lydians and the Medes saw day turned into night, they stopped fighting, and both sides were the more eager that peace should be made between them. Those who brought about their reconciliation were these, Cyanesis the Cilician and Labyntus the Babylonian. It was they who were eager that the oath be made, and they also brought about an exchange of marriages. For they resolved that Astyages son of Cyaxares would receive Ariennes, Aliat's daughter, in marriage. For without a strong compulsion, strong agreements are not apt to hold firm. These nations make their oaths in the same manner as the Greeks, and in addition to this, when they cut their arms to the same depth, they lick up each other's blood. This Astyages, then, was the one whom Cyrus, though he was his own mother's father, conquered and deposed, for a reason I shall explain in a later part of my account. Croesus, holding this against Cyrus, sent to the oracles to ask about marching against the Persians, and once a misleading response arrived, believing it favorable to himself, he marched into Persian territory. When Croesus reached the river Halys, from that point on, as I say, he brought his army across by the bridges that existed there. But according to the common account of the Greeks, Thales of Miletus brought the army across for him. For Croesus could not work out how to get his army over the river, since these bridges, it is said, did not yet exist at that time. It is said that Thales, being present in the camp, he had the river made to flow on the left hand of his army and on the right as well, and he did it this way. Beginning above the camp, he had a deep canal dug, carrying it in a crescent shape, so that it would come around behind the camp as it stood, and there, turned aside along the canal from its old bed, it would pass by the camp and again discharge into the old channel. So that as soon as the river was split, it became fordable on both sides. Some say too that the old channel was completely dried up, but this I do not accept, for how then did they cross it on their way back? Croesus, once he had crossed with his army and arrived in Cappadocia at the place called Tyria, Tyria is the strongest part of that country, lying roughly opposite the city of Sinope on the Euxine Sea, encamped there and ravaged the farms of the Syrians. He took the city of the Tyrians, enslaving its people, and he took all the towns around it as well, driving the Syrians from their homes, though they had done him no wrong. Cyrus meanwhile gathered his own army, and taking along all the peoples who lived between them, marched to meet Croesus. But before setting his army in motion, he sent heralds to the Ionians, trying to detach them from Croesus's side. The Ionians, however, would not be persuaded. When Cyrus arrived and encamped opposite Croesus, there in the land of Tyria, the two put each other to the test with all their strength. A fierce battle was fought, and many fell on both sides, but in the end neither side won, and they parted when night came on. Thus did the two armies contend. Croesus, finding fault with the size of his own force, for the army that had met Cyrus was far smaller than Cyrus's, and blaming this, and since Cyrus did not attempt to attack the next day, marched back to Sardis, intending to call on the Egyptians in accordance with their sworn alliance, his pact with Amasis, Egypt's king, having in fact been made before the one with the Lacedaemonians, and to summon the Babylonians too, an alliance existed with them as well. And at that time Labyntus was king of the Babylonians, and to send word to the Lacedaemonians to be present by a set time. Having gathered these together and assembled his own army, he had resolved to let the winter pass, and then, with the coming of spring, march against the Persians. With this in mind, once he had arrived at Sardis, he sent heralds to his allies proclaiming that they should gather at Sardis within 5 months. But the army he had with him, the one that had fought the Persians, which was made up of foreign mercenaries, he dismissed entirely and disbanded, never expecting that Cyrus, after fighting so evenly matched a battle, would then march on Sardis. While Croesus was thinking this over, the whole area around the city filled up with snakes, and when they appeared, the horses left off grazing in their pastures and went out of their way to eat them up. Seeing this, Croesus judged it to be, as indeed it was, a portent, and at once sent envoys to the interpreters at Telmessus. The envoys arrived, and the Telmessians explained to them what the omen portended, but they had no chance to report it to Croesus, for before they could sail back to Sardis, Croesus had already been captured. The Telmessians, however, concluded that a foreign army was to be expected against Croesus's land, and that when it arrived it would subdue the native people, saying that the snake is a child of the earth, while the horse is an enemy and an invader. This is the answer the Telmessians gave concerning Croesus, though he was already captured, knowing nothing yet of what had happened to Sardis or to Croesus himself. As for Cyrus, as soon as Croesus had marched away after the battle fought at Tyria, learning that Croesus intended, once he had withdrawn, to disband his army, he considered it in his interest to march on Sardis as fast as he could, before the Lydian forces could be gathered a second time. Once he had decided this, he acted on it swiftly. He marched his army into Lydia, and so arrived himself as the messenger of his own coming to Croesus. At this Croesus, thrown into great perplexity, since matters had turned out contrary to what he had expected, nevertheless led the Lydians out to battle. At that time, there was no people in Asia more courageous or more valiant than the Lydians. Their way of fighting was on horseback. They carried great spears and were skilled riders. They came together on the plain that lies before the city of Sardis, a great and open plain, through which flow the river Hyllus and others, all joining the greatest of them, called the Hermus, which flows down from the sacred mountain of the mother Dindymene and empties into the sea near the city of Phocaea. There Cyrus, when he saw the Lydians drawn up for battle, fearing their cavalry, did as the Median Harpagus suggested. He gathered together all the camels that followed his army carrying food and baggage, took off their loads, and mounted men dressed in cavalry gear upon them. Having equipped them this way, he ordered them to advance ahead of the rest of the army against Croesus's cavalry, and he commanded the infantry to follow the camels, while behind the infantry he stationed the whole of his cavalry. When all were arranged in this order, he instructed them that as for the rest of the Lydians, they should kill without mercy anyone who stood in their way, but they were not to kill Croesus himself, even if he resisted when seized. This is what he instructed, and he set the camels facing the enemy cavalry for this reason. A horse is afraid of a camel and cannot bear either the sight of it or the smell of it. This was the very reason for his stratagem, so that Croesus's cavalry, on which he had placed some hope of shining, would be useless to him. And when they joined battle, as soon as the horses caught scent and sight of the camels, they turned back, and Croesus's hope was destroyed. Yet the Lydians, for their part, were not cowards for all that, but when they saw what was happening, they leapt down from their horses and fought the Persians on foot. In time, with heavy losses on both sides, the Lydians were routed and driven back within the wall. They were besieged by the Persians. So the siege was set in place. Croesus, thinking the siege would last a long time, sent out from the wall further messengers to his allies. For the earlier ones had gone out proclaiming that they should gather at Sardis within 5 months, but these he now sent out with all speed, begging for help, since Croesus was under siege. So he sent to all his allies, and in particular to Laestemon. At that very time, it happened that the Spartans themselves were engaged in a dispute with the Argives over a place called Thyre, for the Lacedaemonians had cut off this district of Thyre, which belonged to the territory of the Argives, and held it. The Argive territory also extended, to the west, as far as Malea, both on the mainland and including the island of Cythera and the rest of the islands. When the Argives came to defend their territory being cut off, the two sides met and came to an agreement that 300 from each side should fight, and whichever side prevailed, to them the land should belong. But the main body of each army was to withdraw to its own country and not remain to watch the contest, for fear that, with the armies present, one side, seeing its own men getting the worse of it, would come to their aid. Having agreed on this, they withdrew and picked men from each side left behind joined battle. As they fought, matched evenly out of 600 men there remained 3, of the Argives Alcinor and Chromius, and of the Lacedaemonians Othryades. These were the ones left when night came on. The two surviving Argives, believing they had won, ran off to Argos, but the Lacedaemonian Othryades stripped the armor from the Argive dead, carried it to his own camp, and kept his post in the line. On the second day, both sides arrived to learn the outcome. For a time, each side claimed the victory for itself, the one side saying that more of their own men survived, the other pointing out that the enemy's men had fled while their own man had stayed at his post and stripped the enemy dead. In the end, out of this dispute, they fell to fighting again, and with heavy losses on both sides, the Lacedaemonians won. From that time, the Argives cut their hair short, though before this they had been required by law to grow it long. The Lacedaemonians, by contrast, made a law and a curse that no Argive should grow his hair long, nor should their women wear gold ornaments, until they should recover Thyre. The Lacedaemonians, for their part, made the opposite law. Whereas before this they had not worn their hair long, from that time they did. As for the one man of the 300 left alive, Othryades, they say that, ashamed to return to Sparta when all his comrades in arms had been killed, he took his own life there at Thyre. With affairs standing thus among the Spartans, the herald from Sardis arrived begging them to help Croesus, who was under siege. They, nonetheless, once they had heard the herald, set about preparing to help. And just as they were ready, with their ships prepared, another message arrived that the wall of the Lydians had fallen and Croesus had been taken alive. So then, counting this a great misfortune, they gave up the undertaking. Sardis fell in this way. When it was the 14th day of Croesus's siege, Cyrus sent horsemen through his army proclaiming that he would give gifts to the first man to mount the wall. After this, when the army made an attempt and it did not succeed, and the rest gave up, a man of the Mardians named Hyroades kept trying to climb up at a point of the Acropolis where no guard had been stationed, for it was not thought dangerous there that the place should ever be taken. For the Acropolis is sheer and unassailable at that point. They're not even meals, the former king of Sardis had carried around the lion that his concubine bore him, though the Telmeshans had judged that if the lion were carried around the wall, Sardis would be unconquerable. Meals had carried it around the rest of the wall, at the point that was vulnerable the site of the Acropolis, he disregarded it as being unassailable and sheer. It faces the T-Molus side of the city. This Hyroades the Mardian, seeing on the previous day one of the Lydians come down there from the Acropolis after a helmet had rolled down from above and he had picked it up, took note of it and laid it to heart. And now he himself climbed up, and after him other Persians climbed up as well. And once a good number had mounted in this way, Sardis was captured and the whole city was sacked. As for Croesus himself, this is what happened. He had a son, whom I mentioned before, in other respects a fine young man, but mute. In his former prosperity, Croesus had done everything he could for him, devising various measures, and in particular he had sent to Delphi to ask an oracle about him. The Pythia told him this. Lydian by birth, king of many, O very foolish Croesus, do not wish to hear in your halls the long prayed for sound of your son's voice. It is far better for you that it remain absent, for he will speak for the first time on a day of misfortune. Now when the wall was being taken, one of the Persians, not recognizing Croesus, was coming at him meaning to kill him, and Croesus, seeing him approach, in his present calamity paid him no heed, nor did it matter to him whether he died from the blow. But this mute son of his, seeing the Persian coming toward them, from fear and distress burst into speech and said, "Man, do not kill Croesus." This was the first thing he ever uttered, and after this he continued to speak for the rest of his life. So the Persians took Sardis and captured Croesus himself alive, after he had ruled 14 years and been besieged 14 days, and, in accordance with the oracle, had put an end to his own great empire. The Persians took him and brought him before Cyrus. Cyrus had a great pyre built and set upon it Croesus, bound in fetters, and 27 Lydian boys along with him, intending either to burn these as first fruits to some god, or wishing to fulfill a vow, or perhaps, because he had heard that Croesus was God-fearing. And for this reason set him up on the pyre, wanting to know whether some divine power would save him from being burned alive. He did this, and to Croesus, standing on the pyre, there came, even in such dire trouble, the memory of Solon's words, spoken as if by some god's prompting, that no one among the living is fortunate. As this thought came over him, they say, he heaved a deep sigh and groaned, breaking a long silence and spoke the name Solon 3 times. When Cyrus heard this, he ordered the interpreters to ask Croesus whom he was invoking, and they came up and asked him. Croesus at first kept silent when questioned, but afterward, when he was pressed, he said, "One whom I would have paid a great sum of money to have converse with, before all the rulers of the earth." Since this answer was obscure to them, they asked again what he meant. As they pressed him and grew insistent, he told them how Solon, an Athenian, had once come, and after surveying the whole of his wealth had dismissed it as nothing, saying such and such, and how everything had turned out for him just as Solon had said, though Solon's words applied not so much to him in particular as to all mankind in general, and especially to those who seemed to themselves to be prosperous. While Croesus was relating all this, the pyre had already been lit and the outer edges were burning. And when Cyrus heard from the interpreters what Croesus had said, he had a change of heart, reflecting that he too was a man, and was delivering another man, who had been no less fortunate than himself, alive to the fire. And besides this, fearing retribution, and considering that nothing among human affairs is secure, he ordered the burning fire to be put out as quickly as possible, and Croesus and those with him brought down. But those attempting this were no longer able to master the fire. At this point, so the Lydians say, Croesus, learning of Cyrus's change of heart, when he saw everyone trying to put out the fire but no longer able to check it, cried out, calling upon Apollo, that if any gift of his had ever been pleasing to the god, he should stand by him and rescue him from the present evil. Weeping, he called upon the god, and then, out of a clear and windless sky, clouds suddenly gathered and a storm broke, and it rained with the heaviest of downpours, and the pyre was put out. So Cyrus, learning thereby that Croesus was beloved of the gods and a good man, had him taken down off the pyre and put this question to him. "Croesus, who among men persuaded you to march against my land and become my enemy instead of my friend?" And he said, "O king, I did this for your good fortune and my own misfortune, and the one responsible for it was the god of the Greeks, who spurred me on to make war. No one, after all, is foolish enough to prefer war to peace. In peace sons bury their fathers, but in war fathers bury their sons. But I suppose it was pleasing to the gods that this should come about so. So he spoke. Cyrus then had him unbound and seated him near himself, and treated him with great consideration, and both he and all those around him looked on him with wonder. Croesus, sunk in thought, was silent. But then, turning and watching the Persians sack the Lydian city, he said, O king, should I say to you what I happen to be thinking, or must I keep silent for now? Cyrus told him to take courage and say whatever he wished. So he asked him, saying, This great crowd, what is it doing with such energy? And Cyrus said, It is plundering your city and carrying off your wealth. But Croesus replied, It is not my city nor my wealth that it is plundering. None of this belongs to me any longer. It is your property they are carrying and taking away. Cyrus was troubled by what Croesus said, and having sent the others away, he asked Croesus what he saw and what was being done. Croesus said, Since the gods have given me to you as your slave, I think it right, if I see anything further, to point it out to you. The Persians, being by nature, they are violent men without money. If you allow them to plunder and hold on to great wealth, expect this to follow from it. Whoever of them holds the most, expect that man to rise up against you. Now do as follows, if what I say pleases you. Station guards from your spearmen at every gate, and let them tell those carrying out the goods, taking it from them, that it is necessary for these to be tithed to Zeus. In this way you yourself will not become hateful to them by seizing the goods by force, and they, recognizing that you are acting justly, will give it up willingly. Hearing this, Cyrus was overjoyed, since it seemed to him good advice, and praising it greatly, and instructing his spearmen to carry out what Croesus had suggested, he said to Croesus, Croesus, since you, a man who was king, are resolved to do and say good things, ask for whatever gift you wish to be granted to you at once. And he said, Master, the greatest favor you could do me is to let me send these fetters to that god of the Greeks, the one I honored beyond every other god, and to ask him whether it is his custom to deceive those who do good to him. Cyrus then asked what he was reproaching him for that he made this request. And Croesus recounted to him his whole intent, and the responses of the oracles, and above all the offerings, and how, elated by the oracle, he had made war on the Persians. And as he told this, he came back again to asking to be allowed to reproach the god with this. Cyrus laughed and said, You shall have this from me, Croesus, and anything else you may need at any time. When Croesus heard this, he sent some of the Lydians to Delphi, instructing them to lay the fetters on the threshold of the temple, and ask whether the god was not ashamed to have urged Croesus with his oracles to make war on the Persians, as though he would put an end to Cyrus's power. From which such first fruits as these fetters had come to him, showing the fetters, and to ask this too, whether it was the custom of the Greek gods to be ungrateful. When the Lydians arrived and said what they had been instructed, the Pythia is said to have spoken as follows. Not even a god can escape what fate has ordained. Croesus has paid for the offense of his ancestor 5 generations back, who, being a bodyguard of the Heraclids, followed a woman's treachery and killed his master, and took for himself that man's honor, which belonged to him not at all. Though Loxias was eager that the fall of Sardis should come in the time of Croesus's sons and not upon Croesus himself, turning the fates aside proved impossible. But so far as they yielded, he accomplished it and did Croesus a favor. For he put off the capture of Sardis for 3 years and let Croesus know this, that he was captured 3 years later than was fated. And second, the god came to his aid when he was being burned. As for the oracle that was given, Croesus is wrong to complain. For Loxias had told him beforehand that a campaign against the Persians would mean the destruction of a mighty empire. In the face of that, if he had wished to deliberate well, he ought to have sent and asked whether the empire meant was his own or Cyrus's. But he neither grasped what was said nor asked further, so let him consider himself responsible. Nor, the last time he consulted the oracle, did he grasp what Loxias told him about a mule. For that Cyrus was indeed the mule, for he was born of 2 people not of the same nation, of a better mother and a lesser father. For she was a Mede, and daughter of Astyages the king of the Medes, while he was a Persian and subject to them, and though inferior in every way, he was married to his own mistress. This is what the Pythia answered to the Lydians, and they carried it back to Sardis and reported it to Croesus. And he, hearing it, acknowledged that the fault lay with himself, not with the god. So this is how matters stood regarding Croesus's reign and the first subjugation of Ionia. Croesus has many other offerings in Greece besides those already mentioned. For at Thebes in Boeotia there is a golden tripod, which he dedicated to Ismenian Apollo, and at Ephesus stand the cows of gold and the greater number of the columns. And at the temple of Athena Prania at Delphi, there is a great golden shield. These things were still surviving even down to my own time, while others of the offerings have perished. But the offerings at Branchidae among the Milesians, dedicated by Croesus, are, as I learn, equal in weight and similar to those at Delphi. Those at Delphi and at the shrine of Amphiaraus he dedicated as his own property and from the first fruits of his father's wealth. But the other offerings came from the property of a man who was his enemy, who before he became king had been his political rival, striving to secure the kingship of Lydia for Pantaleon. Pantaleon was a son of Aliats, but Croesus's brother, not by the same mother. Croesus's mother was a Carian woman married to Aliats, while Pantaleon's was an Ionian. And when Croesus, given the throne by his father, took control of the kingdom, he had the man who had opposed him dragged over a carding comb and put to death, and having beforehand consecrated his property to a god, he then dedicated it in the manner described to the places named. So much let be said about the offerings. As for marvels, the land of Lydia does not have very much to write about, such as another land might have, except for the gold dust that comes down from Mount Tmolus. But it does offer one work by far the greatest, apart from the works of the Egyptians and the Babylonians. There is there the tomb of Aliats, the father of Croesus, whose base is of great stones, and the rest of the tomb is a mound of earth. It was built by the market people and the craftsmen and the working girls. 5 boundary markers were still standing on top of the tomb even in my time, and inscriptions had been carved on them showing what each group had done, and when measured, the work done by the girls proved to be the greatest. For the daughters of the Lydian people all prostitute themselves, gathering dowries for themselves, until they marry, doing this, and they give themselves away in marriage. As for the tomb, its circuit measures 6 stadia and 2 plethora, and its width comes to 13 plethora. There is a large lake adjoining the tomb, which the Lydians say never runs dry. It is called the Gygean Lake. So much for that. The Lydians follow customs very similar to those of the Greeks, except that they prostitute their female children. So far as our knowledge goes, they were the earliest to strike gold and silver coinage and put it to use, and the earliest to turn retail traders. The Lydians themselves say that the games now established among both themselves and the Greeks were their own invention. And they say that the games were devised there right around the time they sent out the colony to Tyrrhenia, telling the story as follows. In the reign of Aedes, son of Manes, there was a severe famine throughout all Lydia, and for a while the Lydians endured it patiently, but afterward, when it did not stop, they sought remedies, and different people devised different things. It was then that the forms of dice, knucklebones, the ball, and every other kind of game were invented, except for draughts, for the invention of that the Lydians do not claim as their own. What they did against the famine, having made these inventions, was this. On one of the 2 days they would play games all day, so as not to seek food, and on the next day they would stop playing and eat. In this way they carried on for 18 years. But when the trouble did not let up but pressed on even more, the king of the Lydians then divided all the Lydians into 2 groups and cast lots between them, one to remain and the other to leave the country. And over the group whose lot fell to remain he set himself, the king, in charge, and over the group that was to depart he set his own son, whose name was Tyrrhenus. Those of them to whom the lot fell went down to Smyrna and built ships, in which they loaded all the goods they had that were useful, and sailed off in search of a livelihood and a land, until, after passing by many peoples, they came to the Ambraci, where they founded cities and have lived to this day. Instead of Lydians, they were renamed after the king's son who had led them out, taking their name from him and being called Tyrrhenians. So the Lydians were enslaved by the Persians. From this point, our account seeks out both who this Cyrus was who destroyed the empire of Croesus, and by what means the Persians came to lead Asia. As some of the Persians tell it, those who do not wish to glorify the story of Cyrus, but to tell it as it really was, I shall write it accordingly, though I know of three other paths of the story about Cyrus that could be told. When the Assyrians had ruled Upper Asia for 520 years, the first to begin to revolt from them were the Medes, and somehow these, fighting the Assyrians for their freedom, proved themselves brave men, and having thrown off servitude, they became free. Following their lead, the other nations did the same thing. With everyone now self-governing throughout the continent, they came round again to monarchy in the following way. There was among the Medes a clever man whose name was Deoses, son of Phraortes. This Deoses, desiring tyranny, did as follows. The Medes being settled in villages, he, being already a man of standing in his own village, applied himself even more eagerly and zealously to the practice of justice. And he did this though there was much lawlessness throughout all Media, knowing that injustice is hostile to justice. And the Medes of his own village, seeing his ways, chose him as their judge. And he, since indeed he was aiming at rule, was straight and just, and doing this he won no small praise from his fellow citizens, so much so that when those in the other villages, that Deoses was a man who alone judged rightly. Then, since they had previously suffered from unjust verdicts, when they heard this they came gladly, going to Deoses themselves to have their cases judged, and in the end they entrusted themselves to no one else. As the number of people coming to him kept growing, since they learned that the verdicts turned out in accordance with the facts, Deoses, realizing that everything now depended on him, was no longer willing to sit where he had previously sat and given judgment, and he said he would judge no longer. For it did not profit him, he said, to neglect his own affairs and spend the whole day judging those of his neighbors. Since robbery and lawlessness were now far more rampant throughout the villages than before, the Medes gathered together in one place and took counsel with one another about the present state of affairs. As I suppose, it was above all Deos's friends who said, "Since we cannot go on living in this land under the present conditions, come, let us set up a king for ourselves. That way the country can be properly governed, and we can return to our own work, instead of being driven from our homes by lawlessness." Speaking in some such way, they persuaded themselves to be ruled by a king. At once, when they put forward candidates for whom they should set up as king, Deoses was proposed and praised by everyone by a wide margin, until at last they settled on him as king. He then ordered them to build him a house worthy of his kingship, and to strengthen him with a bodyguard of spearmen. And the Medes did so. They built him a great and strong house wherever in the land he indicated, and they allowed him to select bodyguards for himself from among all the Medes. And he, once he had gained power, compelled the Medes to build a single city and to devote their attention to fortifying and adorning this one, giving less care to the others. Since the Medes obeyed him in this too, he built great and strong walls, the ones now called Ecbatana, one circle standing within another. This wall has been so contrived that each successive circle rises above the one before it only by the height of its battlements alone and nothing more. The nature of the site, being a hill, contributes something to making it so, but more than that, it was deliberately designed this way. There are seven circles in all, and within the innermost one lie the royal palace and the treasuries. The largest of these walls is about the size of the wall around Athens. Of the first circle's battlements are white, the second's black, the third circle's crimson, the fourth's dark blue, the fifth's orange. Thus the battlements of five circles are colored with dyes, but the last two have their battlements plated, one with silver and the other with gold. All these fortifications Deoses built for himself and around his own dwelling, and he ordered the rest of the people to live around the outer wall. When all the building was complete, Deoses was the first to establish the following order: that no one should be admitted to the king's presence, but that everything should be done through messengers, and that no one was to lay eyes on the king, and further, that it should be shameful for anyone to laugh or spit in his presence. He surrounded himself with this solemnity for the following reason: so that his agemates, who had been raised with him and were of no lesser family, nor inferior to him in manly virtue, should not, by seeing him, feel resentment and plot against him, but instead, by not seeing him, should think him a different sort of being altogether. When he had arranged all this and secured himself in his tyranny, he was strict in guarding justice. People wrote out their cases and sent them in to him, and he, after deciding on the cases submitted to him, sent them back out. This is what he did concerning legal cases, but he had also arranged other matters as follows. If he learned that anyone was committing an outrage, he would summon that person and punish him according to the seriousness of each offense, and he had spies and eavesdroppers throughout the whole land he ruled. Deoses, then, united only the Median nation and ruled over it. Now the tribes of the Medes are these, the Buci, the Paratasni, the Strachates, the Arizanti, the Budii, and the Magi. These, then, are the tribes of the Medes. Deoses had a son, Phraortes, who, when Deoses died after ruling for 53 years, succeeded to the rule. Having taken it over, he was not content to rule the Medes alone, but campaigned against the Persians and attacked them first of all, making them the first people subject to the Medes. Then, having these two nations, both of them strong, he brought Asia under his control, moving from nation to nation, until he campaigned against the Assyrians, that is, those Assyrians who held Nineveh and had formerly ruled over all, but who at that time were left isolated by their allies, who had revolted from them, though otherwise their own affairs were in good order. Against these Phraortes campaigned, and he himself was destroyed, having ruled 22 years, and so was the greater part of his army. When Phraortes died, he was succeeded by Cyaxares, son of Phraortes, son of Deoses. This man is said to have been far more warlike than his ancestors, and he was the first to organize the peoples of Asia into companies, and the first to arrange separately each group, the spearmen, the archers, and the cavalry. Before this, all had been mixed together indiscriminately in confusion. This is the man who fought against the Lydians when day turned to night for them during the battle, and who brought together under himself all of Asia beyond the Halys River. Having gathered together all those under his rule, he marched against Nineveh, both to avenge his father and wishing to take that city. And when, having joined battle, he defeated the Assyrians, while he was besieging Nineveh, a great army of Scythians came upon him, led by their king Madais, son of Protothais. These had invaded Asia after driving the Sumerians out of Europe, and pursuing them in their flight, they thus arrived in the land of the Medes. A traveler going light needs 30 days to pass from Lake Meotes to the river Phases and the land of the Colchians, and from Colchis it is not far to cross over into Media. Only one nation lies between them, the Saspires, and once past this one, one is already in Media. However, the Scythians did not invade by this route, but turned aside onto the upper road, much longer, keeping the Caucasus Mountains on their right. There the Medes met the Scythians in battle, and having been defeated in the battle, they were deprived of their empire. The Scythians occupied all of Asia. From there, they marched on Egypt. And when they had reached Palestinian Syria, Psammetichus, king of Egypt, met them with gifts and entreaties and turned them back from advancing further. And when, on their way back, they reached the Syrian city of Ascalon, the bulk of the Scythian force passed through causing no harm, but a few stragglers left behind plundered the temple of the heavenly Aphrodite. This temple, as I have learned by inquiry, is the oldest of all the temples of this goddess. For the one in Cyprus originated from it, as the Cyprians themselves say, and the one in Cythera was founded by Phoenicians who came from the same land of Syria. On those Scythians who plundered the temple at Ascalon, and on their descendants forever after, the goddess inflicted a female sickness. So that the Scythians say they suffer from this affliction for that reason, and that visitors to the land of Scythia can see for themselves how those whom the Scythians call the Anares are afflicted. Now the Scythians ruled Asia for 28 years, and everything was thrown into disorder by their violence and negligence. For besides exacting tribute from each people, which they imposed on each, they also plundered, riding about and seizing whatever each people had. Most of these Scythians Cyaxares and the Medes invited to a feast, made drunk and slaughtered. And thus the Medes recovered their empire and gained mastery over the same peoples as before, and they took Nineveh. How they took it, I will explain in another account, and made the Assyrians subject to them, except for the portion belonging to Babylon. After this, Cyaxares died, having ruled 40 years, including the years the Scythians ruled, and Astyages, son of Cyaxares, succeeded to the kingship. A daughter was born to him, and he gave her the name Mandane. Astyages dreamed that she urinated so much that it filled his own city and flooded all of Asia besides. He related this dream to those of the Magi who interpreted dreams, and he was frightened when he learned the details from them. Later, when this Mandane was of age for marriage, He gave her to no Mede of rank equal to his own, fearing the vision, but gave her instead to a Persian called Cambyses, a man he judged to be of good family, but of a quiet disposition, ranking him far below a Mede of middle rank. While Mandane was living with Cambyses, in that first year, Astyages had a second vision. He dreamed that from his daughter's genitals grew a vine, and that this vine covered the whole of Asia. Having seen this and related it to the dream interpreters, he sent for his daughter from the Persians, she being pregnant, and when she arrived, he kept her under guard, wishing to destroy whatever should be born of her. For the dream interpreters of the Magi had indicated to him from his vision that his daughter's offspring was destined to become king in his place. Guarding against this, Astyages, when Cyrus was born, summoned Harpagus, a man of his household, most trusted among the Medes and overseer of all his affairs, and said to him the following: Harpagus, do not mishandle in any way the matter I am about to lay before you, nor betray me by choosing others afterward and thereby falling into trouble yourself. Take the child that Mandane bore, carry it to your own house, and kill it, then bury it in whatever manner you yourself wish. He answered, O king, never before have you found this man to be lacking in obedience. Nothing wrong, and we are on guard not to commit any offense against you, now or in time to come. But if this is truly what you wish to happen, then it is my duty to serve you properly in the matter. Having answered in these terms, Harpagus, once the child had been handed over to him dressed for death, went off weeping toward his house, and when he arrived, he told his wife the whole speech Astyages had spoken. She said to him, So now what do you intend to do? He answered, Not what Astyages ordered, not even if he goes out of his mind and rages worse than he rages now will I fall in with his purpose or serve him in a murder of this kind. There are many reasons I will not kill him. First, that the boy is my own kinsman, and also that Astyages is old and has no male offspring. If after he dies, the throne should pass to this daughter of his, whose son he is now having me kill, what is left for me afterward but the greatest of dangers? No, for my own safety this child must die, but it must be one of Astyages' own men who becomes his murderer, and not one of mine. So he said, and at once sent a messenger to one of Astyages' herdsmen whom he knew to pasture his flocks in ground most suitable for the purpose, in the wildest of the mountains. The man was called Mitridates, and sharing his home was a fellow slave, a woman known in the Greek tongue as Sino, and in the Median as Spaco, for dog the Medes call Spaca. The foothills where this herdsman kept his cattle pastures lie to the north of Agbatana, toward the Euxine Sea, for in that direction the Median territory borders on that of the Saspares and is very mountainous, high, and thickly wooded, while the rest of Media is entirely flat. When the herdsman arrived, summoned in great haste, Harpagus spoke to him thus, Astyages orders you to take this child and leave it in the loneliest region of the mountains, there to die as swiftly as possible. He further ordered me to tell you this. If you do not kill it but preserve it by some means, you will be put to the worst of deaths. I myself am appointed to see that it is exposed. Hearing this, the herdsman took up the child and went back the same way he had come, arriving at his steading. Now it happened that his own wife, who had been due to give birth any day, that very day, by some divine chance, gave birth while the herdsman was gone to the city. Both of them were anxious about the other, he fearing for his wife's delivery, and she wondering why Harpagus, so unusually, had sent for her husband. When he returned and stood before her, she, seeing him unexpectedly, asked first what had made Harpagus send for him so urgently. He said, Wife, I saw and heard, when I went to the city, what I wish I had neither seen nor ever happened to our masters. The whole house of Harpagus was overcome with weeping, and I, astonished, went inside. As soon as I entered, I saw an infant lying there, kicking and crying, adorned with gold and embroidered clothing. When Harpagus saw me, he ordered me to take up the child at once and carry it off and set it where the mountains are most infested with wild beasts, saying it was Astyages who had laid this task on me, and threatening many things if I did not do it. And I took it up and carried it, thinking it belonged to one of the household servants, for I could never have guessed where it really came from. But I was astonished to see it decked out in gold and fine clothes, and moreover the plain weeping going on in Harpagus' house. Then presently, on the road, I learned the whole story from a servant who had escorted me out of the city and put the infant into my hands, that it was the child of Mandane, daughter of Astyages, and of Cambyses, son of Cyrus, and that Astyages ordered it killed. and now here it is. While speaking these words, the herdsman drew back the covering and showed her the child. Noticing at once how large and well-formed the boy was, she burst into tears, and clasping her husband's knees, begged him by no means to expose it. But he said he could not do otherwise, for spies would come from Harpagus to check on it, and he would die a most terrible death if he did not do as ordered. Since she could not persuade her husband, the woman then said this: "Since I cannot persuade you not to expose it, then do this, since it is altogether necessary that a child be seen exposed. I too have given birth, and I have given birth to a dead child. Take this one and expose it, and let us raise the daughter of Astyages' son as if it were our own. In this way, you will not be caught wronging our masters, nor will we have planned badly for ourselves. For the dead child will receive a royal burial, and the living one will not lose his life." The herdsman thought his wife spoke very well for their present circumstance, and he did just as she said. He handed over to his wife the child he had been carrying to kill, and taking his own dead child, he laid it in the receptacle in which he had carried the other, and, dressing it in all the finery of the other child, carried it out and set it in the most desolate part of the mountains. On the third day after the infant had been exposed, the herdsman went to the city, leaving one of his herdsmen to watch over it, and going to Harpagus' house, he said he was ready to show the body of the child. Harpagus sent the most trusted of his own bodyguard, and through them he both viewed and buried the herdsman's child. That one was buried, but the other, who was afterward named Cyrus, was taken and raised by the herdsman's wife, who gave him some other name, not Cyrus. By the time the boy had reached his 10th year, an incident revealed who he truly was. He was playing in that village where these herdsmen's steadings were, playing alongside other children his age out on the road. In their game, the children picked this very boy to be their king, the one who passed as the herdsman's son. He then assigned some of them to build houses, others to be bodyguards, one of them, I suppose, to be the king's eye, and to another he gave the honor of carrying messages, assigning each a task. Now one of these boys taking part in the game, the son of Artimberes, a man of standing among the Medes, since he did not do as Cyrus ordered. Cyrus told the other boys to seize him, and when the boys obeyed, Cyrus handled the boy very roughly, flogging him severely. As soon as he was released, feeling he had suffered indignities unworthy of himself, he was all the more resentful, and going down to the city he complained to his father of what he had suffered at Cyrus' hands, though he did not yet call him Cyrus, since that was not yet his name, but called him the son of Astyages' herdsman. Artimberes, in the anger he felt, went to Astyages, bringing his son with him, and said he had suffered outrageous treatment, saying, "O king, we have been so grossly insulted by your slave, the herdsman's son," showing the boy's shoulders. Hearing and seeing this, Astyages, wishing to avenge the boy for the sake of Artimberes' rank, sent for the herdsman and the boy. When both had arrived, Astyages, looking at Cyrus, said, "You, the son of such a man as this, dared to treat so outrageously this man's son who ranks first with me?" He answered thus, "Master, I did this to him justly. For the boys of the village, among whom he too was one, in their play made me their king, for they thought me the most fit for it." Now the other boys did what was assigned to them, but this one refused to listen and paid no heed, until he got his punishment. "If for this I deserve any harm, here I am ready." While the boy was speaking, a recognition of him came over Astyages, and it seemed to him that the features of the boy's face resembled his own, and that his manner of answering was too free for a slave, and that the time of the exposure seemed to match the boy's age. Struck by these things, he was speechless for a while, and with difficulty, when he had recovered himself, he said, wishing to send Artimberes away so that he might question the herdsman alone, "Artimberes, I will see to it that you and your son have no cause for complaint." So he sent Artimberes away, and the attendants led Cyrus inside at Astyages' command. When the herdsman was left alone by himself, Astyages asked him this, where he had gotten the boy, and who had given him to him. He said the boy had been born of himself, and that the woman who bore him was still with him. Astyages said he was not planning well in wishing to bring himself to such extremities, and as he said this, he signaled to his bodyguards to seize him. And as he was led away to torture, the herdsman then revealed the true account. Beginning from the start, he went through it faithfully, and ended by falling to entreaty and begging Astyages to forgive him. Astyages, once the herdsman had revealed the truth, now made little of the matter regarding him, but blaming Harpagus greatly, he ordered his bodyguards to summon him. When Harpagus came before him, Astyages asked him, "Harpagus, by what death did you dispose of the child I gave over to you, born of my daughter?" When Harpagus saw that the herdsman was there, he did not turn to a false account, so as not to be caught out if tested, but said this, "O king, once the child was in my hands, I thought over how I might do as you wished and yet, in dealing with you, be free of blame and not be the one who killed either your daughter's child or you yourself. I did as follows. I called the herdsman and handed over the child to this man, telling him that it was you who ordered it killed. And in saying that I did not lie, for you had indeed commanded it. But I gave it to him with these instructions, to expose it on a deserted mountain, remaining there to keep watch until it died, threatening him with every punishment if he did not carry this out. And when he had done as ordered and the child had died, I sent the most trustworthy of the eunuchs and through them saw and buried it. So it stands, O king, concerning this matter, and such was the fate the boy met." Harpagus then told the straightforward account. But Astyages, hiding the anger he held against him for what had happened, first, just as he had heard the matter from the herdsman himself, repeated it back to Harpagus, and afterward, once it had been gone over again, he came around to saying that the boy was alive and that things had turned out well. "For over what was done to this child," he said, "I suffered greatly, and being at odds with my own daughter was no light thing for me. Now that fortune has turned out well, first send your own son to the newly arrived boy, and second, for I intend to sacrifice thank offerings for the child's survival to the gods, to whom this honor is due, come to me for dinner." When Harpagus heard this, he bowed low, and thinking it a great thing both that his error had turned out for the best, and that he had been invited to dinner on so happy an occasion, went to his house. And entering as quickly as he could, since he had one only son, about 13 years old, he sent him off, telling him to go to Astyages and do whatever he might order. And he himself, overjoyed, told his wife what had happened. But Astyages, when Harpagus's son arrived, slaughtered him and cut him limb from limb, roasting some of the meat and boiling the rest, and having it prepared, kept it ready. When the hour of dinner came and the other guests were present along with Harpagus, tables laden with mutton were set before the others and before Astyages himself. But before Harpagus was set everything of his own son, except the head and the extremities of the hands and feet, these lay apart on a covered basket. And when Harpagus seemed to have had enough of the food, Astyages asked him whether he had enjoyed the feast. Harpagus replied that the meal had pleased him greatly, and then those whose task it was brought forward the covered head of the boy, and his hands and feet, and told Harpagus to step up, uncover them, and take whichever of them he wished. Harpagus obeyed, and uncovering it, he saw the remains of his son. Seeing them, he was not overcome, but kept himself in hand. Astyages asked him whether he recognized what animal's meat he had eaten. He said that he did recognize it, and that whatever the king did was pleasing to him. Having answered thus, he collected the leftover meat and made his way home, intending, I suppose, to gather it all together and bury it. Such was the punishment Astyages inflicted on Harpagus. But concerning Cyrus, in deliberating about him, he called the same magi who had interpreted the dream for him in that way. When they arrived, Astyages asked them how they had interpreted the vision. They said the same as before, that the boy was fated to become king if he had lived and not died earlier. He answered them thus, "The boy exists and is alive, and the village boys set him up as their king while he was living out in the country. And he carried out all the things that true kings actually do. He appointed spear-bearers and doorkeepers and message-bearers and all the rest, and ruled with these arrangements in place. Now, what do you think this points to?" The magi said, "If the boy is alive and has become king without any design behind it, then take courage on that account and keep a good heart, for he will not rule a second time. Even some of our prophecies come to fulfillment in trivial ways, and matters concerning dreams especially tend to come to nothing significant." Astyages answered them thus, "I myself, O Magi, am very much of that same opinion, that once the boy was named king the dream was fulfilled, and that he is no longer in any way dangerous to me. Nevertheless, consider carefully and advise me what will be safest for my household and for you." To this, the Magi said, "O king, it matters greatly to us as well that your rule stand secure. For otherwise it passes away over to this boy, a Persian, and becomes foreign to us, and we, being Medes, would be enslaved and counted for nothing by the Persians as foreigners. But while you remain established as king, being one of our own people, we too rule our share and receive great honors from you. So in every way we must look out for you and for your rule. And now if we saw anything to fear in this, we would have told you everything beforehand. But since the dream has come to nothing significant, we ourselves take courage, and we urge the same courage on you. Send this boy out of your sight, off to the Persians and to those who bore him. Hearing this, Astyages was glad and, calling Cyrus, said to him, "My boy, I wronged you because of a dream vision that came to nothing, but by your own destiny you survive. Now go then, rejoicing, to the Persians, and I will send an escort with you. When you get there, you will find a father and mother quite different from Mitridates the herdsman and his wife." Having said this, Astyages sent Cyrus away. When he returned to Cambyses's house, he was received by his parents. And having received him, once they learned who he was, they welcomed him warmly, since they knew that he had died at that time long before, and they asked him by what means he had survived. He explained to them that until then he had been ignorant and greatly mistaken about it, and that on the road he had learned the whole story of his own fate, that he knew he was said to be the son of Astyages's herdsman, but that on the journey from there, he had learned the whole account from those escorting him. He said he had been raised by the herdsman's wife, and he praised her constantly throughout his account, and in his telling everything centered on Sino. His parents took up this name, so that it might seem to the Persians all the more marked by divine favor that their son had survived, and they put about the story that Cyrus, when exposed, had been suckled by a dog. From there, this story has spread. As Cyrus grew to manhood and became the most manly and best-liked of his peers, Harpagus attached himself to him, sending him gifts, desiring to take vengeance on Astyages. For he himself, being a private man, saw no way that vengeance could come upon Astyages, but seeing Cyrus growing up, he made him his ally, likening Cyrus's own sufferings to his. And even before this, he had accomplished the following. Since Astyages was harsh toward the Medes, Harpagus, meeting with each of the leading Medes individually, persuaded them that they must put Cyrus forward and stop Astyages from ruling. When this had been accomplished by him and all was ready, then, since Cyrus was living among the Persians, Harpagus, wishing to reveal his own intent to him, had no other way of doing so, since the roads were guarded, and so he contrived the following, preparing a hare and slitting open its belly without plucking out any of the fur. Just as it was, he inserted a written scroll, having written on it what seemed best to him. Then, sewing up the hare's belly again, and giving nets to the most trustworthy of his servants as though he were a huntsman, he sent him off to the Persians, instructing him by word of mouth in handing over the hare to Cyrus, to tell him that he must open it himself with his own hands, allowing nobody to be with him while he did it. This, then, was carried out, and Cyrus, taking the hare, cut it open, and finding the scroll inside it, he took it and read it through. The writing said this, "Son of Cambyses, the gods watch over you, for otherwise you would never have come to such good fortune. Now take vengeance on Astyages, your murderer. For as far as his intent went, you are dead, but as far as the gods and I are concerned, you live. This I think you have long since learned in full, both what was done concerning you, and what I suffered at the hands of Astyages, because I did not kill you but gave you to the herdsmen. Now, if you are willing to listen to me, you shall rule over all the land which Astyages now rules. Persuade the Persians to revolt and lead an army against the Medes. And whether I am appointed by Astyages as general against you or some other of the notable Medes is, the outcome will be what you wish, for these men will be the first to revolt from him and come over to your side and try to bring Astyages down. Since matters here are ready, do this, and do it quickly." Hearing this, Cyrus considered by what cleverest means he might persuade the Persians to revolt, and upon consideration he found the following to be most fitting, and this is what he did. Writing on a scroll what he wished, he called an assembly of the Persians, and then, unrolling the scroll and reading from it, he said that Astyages was appointing him general of the Persians. "And now," he said, "O Persians, I proclaim to you that each of you must present himself equipped with a sickle." Thus Cyrus made his proclamation. There is many tribes of Persians, and Cyrus brought some of these together and won them over to rebel against the Medes. These are the tribes from which all the other Persians are descended, the Passargadi, the Marafai, and the Maspii. Of these, the Passargadi are the noblest. Among them is also the clan of the Achaemenids, from which the Persaid kings are descended. Other Persians are these, the Panthialii, the Drusii, the Germani. All these are farmers, while the rest are nomads. The Dons, the Mardi, the Dropasi, the Sagartai. When all had arrived bringing what had been ordered, then Cyrus. There was a certain place in Persia covered with thorn bushes, about 18 or 20 stadia in every direction, told them to clear this place in a single day. When the Persians had accomplished the task set before them, he told them a second time to be present on the following day having bathed. Meanwhile, Cyrus gathered together all his father's goats, sheep, and cattle in one place and sacrificed them, and made preparations to receive the Persian army, together with wine and food of the finest quality. When the Persians arrived the next day, he had them recline on the meadow and feasted them well. Once dinner was over, Cyrus put a question to them whether they preferred what they had had the day before or what they had now. They said there was a great difference between the two. The previous day had held nothing but hardship for them, while the present day held nothing but good things. Taking up this remark, Cyrus laid bare the whole matter, saying, "Men of Persia, this is how things stand for you. If you are willing to obey me, you will have this and countless other good things, with no toil that befits a slave. But if you are unwilling to obey me, you will have toils numberless, like the one of yesterday. So now, obey me and become free. For I believe I was born by divine fortune to bring these things about, and I consider you men no lesser than the Medes, either in other respects or in matters of war. Since this is how things stand, revolt from Astyages as quickly as possible." The Persians, having found a champion, gladly threw off their bondage, since they had long resented being ruled by the Medes. When Astyages learned that Cyrus was doing this, he sent a messenger and summoned him. Cyrus told the messenger to report that he would come to Astyages sooner than Astyages himself would wish. Hearing this, Astyages armed all the Medes, and since he was struck with madness by the gods, he appointed Harpagus as their general, forgetting what he had done to him. When the Medes marched out and engaged the Persians, some of them fought, those who had had no part in the plot, while others deserted to the Persians, and most of them shirked their duty deliberately and fled. When the Median army was disgracefully dispersed, as soon as Astyages learned of this, he said, threatening Cyrus, "But even so, Cyrus will not rejoice." Having said this, he first impaled the dream interpreters among the Magi who had convinced him to spare Cyrus's life, and then he armed those remaining in the city of the Medes, both young men and old. Leading these out and engaging the Persians, he was defeated, and he himself was taken alive, and he lost the Medes he had brought out with him. When Astyages was a captive, Harpagus came up to him and gloated over him and mocked him, and among other painful words he spoke to him, he also asked him, referring to the dinner at which Astyages had feasted him on the flesh of his own son, what his own slavery felt like now in place of kingship. And Astyages looked at him and asked in turn whether he claimed Cyrus's deed as his own. Harpagus replied that, having written the letter himself, the affair was indeed rightly his. Astyages then declared him to be, by that logic, the most foolish and most unjust of all men, most foolish, because if it was through his own doing that these things had come about, he could have become king himself, yet instead he set the power on another, and most unjust, since it was that very dinner which led him to enslave the Medes.